And here today on Midday, I'm delighted that my guest is Baltimore City Inspector General Isabel Mercedes Cumming. Her office is in charge of weeding out waste and fraud and abuse in our city government. Last year, her office launched several high-profile investigations into poor working conditions of the Department of Public Works. They looked into a cyber theft of more than $1.5 million and cost overruns in the redesign of the city's website. So according to the IG's annual report, Inspector General Cumming and her team uncovered nearly $11 million in savings for the city. And she joins me here in Studio A. It's good to see you. Welcome back.
It's great to see you. Thank you so much. YPR is so important to this city, and I do hope everybody subscribes because the reporting that we get from you has always been top-notch.
Well, we are grateful for your support and grateful to everybody who's been supporting us in this first day of our membership campaign. You've just recently released an annual report where you kind of recap the things that you did over the past year. When you say you've identified $11 million in savings, that certainly more than pays for your office by a lot. How do you make that determination? What's the metric you use?
That's a great question. Every time we do issue a report or we do investigation, we actually track the amount of funds that either we saved or that we found. And so we keep a running total, and that's how it has. So I have an entire chart of which case and where the monies came from. And we have been doing that from the beginning. So in total, the office has probably saved close to $60 million over the 8 years that I've been here.
Yeah, you've been there. This is your second term. How many reports did you issue this year? I mean, you don't issue a report on every single thing that you look into by any means, but how many did we end up with this year?
We issued 35 reports, and the thing that we do in addition is called a referral, and we issued 103 of those. That's when we don't have the time to do a whole big investigation, but we know that it can be quickly fixed by the agency. So we send the agency a letter outlining the situation that we received from the public, and we give them 3 weeks to get back to us. Interestingly enough, the DPW case started as a referral. And when we get information back, we went back and checked to see if what they told us had been corrected. And that started the entire DPW investigation.
Yeah, and the Department of Public Works, you issued several reports.
Seven.
About that. Seven, to be exact. So you stuck with that over a long period of time. But that began with a phone call from somebody, right? Just
it
like
did.
All of your, many of your
reports
all
do. Of ours. Yeah. We work for the people. So we get our complaints from the people. There's no like OIG star chamber where we pick which cases we're going to look at. That's not the way it works. We work and our cases come from complaints we receive. And last year we received 898, almost 900.
Yeah.
The year before it was over 1,000.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and these are, people calling. They call anonymously sometimes. Sometimes they identify themselves and they say, hey, this doesn't seem right. I'm with this particular agency, or I'm a contractor with the city. I'm looking at it from outside in.
Yep.
When you, for example, with the DPW, what did you hear in that initial phone call? And then how did you proceed once you got that information?
Well, the initial call was concerning the unbelievable conditions that they claimed that they had. They claimed that they had no water, that they had that where their cooling station was over 100 degrees, we were told. And they kept saying that, everything was so bad. So I actually sent two of my investigators out even before we did the referral and said, is there validity to this? And they said, oh, yeah. So then we sent an emergency because it involves safety. Anytime safety is involved, you got to get back to me within a week. So we sent a safety thing out and telling them there was lack of water, there was lack of electrolytes, there was lack of there at that point we hadn't learned about the toilet paper.
Because we're talking about sanitation workers
in
the heat of the summer.
Yes, we are.
And there was even a man who passed away.
Mr. Ronald Silver.
Mr. Silver from heat exhaustion.
Yeah.
Very sad.
It was, in fact, I don't know if you noticed, but our annual report is actually dedicated to his memory because we did an entire report about exactly what happened. Because in order to make things change, you have to understand what we had, and then we have to fix it. So in this case, I sent my workers out, so I wrote to DPW. We outlined the situation. We got back, so fast, 4 days, I got back a response outlining how they had water, they had this, they had that, things were fixed. That wasn't true. In fact, what happened was we actually went out the next day at 5 o'clock in the morning, and that's when we discovered there was no water. In fact, there was a dirty trash can filled with just a bottle floating, disgusting. And then we went into the room, and it was 85 degrees. She had sweat on her face, and I said, and that was at 6 o'clock in the morning. So that started what has now become the change in the culture of DPW.
And when you discover those kinds mm-hmm. of conditions, for example, is it up to you and your office to prescribe what the remedy is? Mm. Do you say you must do A, B, C, D, and E? Uh-uh. You just say, okay, here's these conditions. Get back to me and tell me what you've done.
Right. We shine a light on the truth. So what was important with the DPW case was the pictures, because a lot of time media can't get back there. They can't see what's happening. So we had pictures. We had pictures that, you know, the men at Bowley's didn't have toilet paper. And they hadn't had toilet paper for over a year. That was because someone decided you should ask for toilet paper. The water, they had no water, or the water was locked up. I mean, the conditions.
Let's remind folks about that. Okay. When it comes to toilet paper, yes. This is at Bowley's Quarters, which was one of the sanitation, depots. If you needed to use the restroom, you had to ask somebody who kept the toilet paper under lock and key.
Yeah, you had to ask. You had to ask the person for toilet paper in order to be given.
A supervisor.
Only the men, though. Only the men.
And this was for, there must have been a reason for this little policy.
Well, a lot of reason for a lot of things is control, but I was told the reason was because there were toilet paper thieves. My office had gone to 10 different DPW locations, and if that's the logic, then why are all toilet paper thieves located at Bowley's? Because nobody else had that type of control.
But you don't issue a report that says you must make
no.
toilet paper available for the workers at Bowley's.
No. How could I? I'm not. I don't have that ability. That is the administration, and that is what the change holders can do. I'm the investigator. So, I will give tremendous credit to the director, Khalil.
Khalil Zaid, who's now a deputy mayor, so he's no longer overseeing just DPW. He's overseeing emergency management and Department of Transportation and a number of other things.
Yeah, he actually went out. He actually engaged the workers. He actually, I think if you take the time to talk and listen, because my office actually interviewed over 130 workers. That's how we learned about so many things that had been happening for so long here in Baltimore. For instance, why is it that one-fifth the workers didn't have health insurance? In fact, both men on the truck that Mr. Silver died on, neither one had health insurance. Neither one. So what we learned was that they weren't given the opportunity. A lot of the workers were second chance employees, and they weren't given the tools that you need to succeed.
Let's remind folks what a second chance employee is.
A second chance employee is a person that sometimes has a difficult time getting a job because they were incarcerated. And it's basically that Baltimore City will give people a second chance. And many of the workers have been there for a very long time. And so what happened was, they ended up with the insurance. We ended up upon realizing for the first time, because nobody had ever asked, do these men have insurance? What in the city of Baltimore will give you $2,500 credit if you don't get insurance. Now, these men are making close to $40,000. Do you know not one of the 135 workers that didn't have insurance, not one took the credit? So that's where I knew there was a tremendous communication gap. And in the end, my office, My work phone, we sent out 135 text messages, not once, but twice, to let these gentlemen know where we were going to have, where Zaid had set up a system where in the Office of the Inspector General to help them learn how to get insurance. And in the end, over 100 men now have health insurance that didn't have before.
Yeah, it wasn't as if they had been denied health insurance. It was that in most cases, they just didn't know they were even eligible for it.
Well, they didn't know they had to sign up for it. Sometimes there's a real disconnect. Everybody says, oh, just go on the computer and sign up. Well, what if you don't have a computer? Many of these men don't have computers. What they have are phones. And you try signing up for insurance on our Workday system with a phone. It is so difficult. I couldn't do it. So they were put in an unusual and difficult situation. I mean, you have to think. I have to think of the community. So in the end, we ended up, now there's computers at the different. Something like that can make a tremendous difference.
Isabel Mercedes Cumming is the Inspector General of the City of Baltimore. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you have a question for Inspector General Cumming, our number here at Midday, and this is a different number than the number you use to pledge, but our number to talk to Inspector General Cumming is 410-662-8780. You can come to midday@wypr.org. That's a email address you can use if you have a question that you'd like me to pose to the Inspector General. You say in your report that there are 38 active cases and 24 pending cases. So what's the difference between those two?
That is what caused my desperate plea this year for an additional worker. What I have is 24 cases that we have determined are valid cases, but I don't have enough people to do it. So I have, with my current staff, I have 38 active cases going. I have 24.
So those are investigations that are ongoing.
Yep, ongoing. Mm-hmm. And then I have 24, what we have determined are legitimate investigations that we can't get to. Mm-hmm. So we fought very hard, and in the end, we ended up getting a new employee. They ended up, shockingly, taking the only other apparently empty pin was from the state's attorney's office. So they took, that's where we got our person.
So in 2020, there were 13 positions in the IG's office. And as of this year, there are 18 positions. Is that going to be adequate moving forward?
I actually had asked for 20. I currently have 19 now.
And the state's attorney asked for a few more as well.
Yeah, but he has over 200, mm-hmm. I mean, but you can see throughout the city that the increase in other offices. I mean, if you look at almost every office, because I had a chart that I was giving that outlined how many different. I remember there were 14 in Monsey. There were 14, I believe, 13 in the mayor's office. There was a lot throughout the city. So there was opportunities. But yet, if you look at my office, I haven't had an increase since 2022.
So 3 years.
That's a long time considering how many cases we've done and what we're doing.
Sure. Yeah. And when we're talking about $60 million saved
exactly.
Over your tenure.
I don't cost the city.
Yeah, right. No, yeah. Putatively, you're making money for
exactly.
The city.
Exactly. So this is where you want the money to go.
That's a good thing. All right. That's Baltimore City's Inspector General Isabel Mercedes Cumming. And we will return to our conversation with the Inspector General in just a bit. And now back to our conversation with Isabel Mercedes Cumming, the Inspector General of the City of Baltimore. So, Isabel, you have an advisory board. Let's talk about the setup. Mm-hmm. People were brought to mind of the setups of various inspector generals because there was a big controversy about renewing the contract of your colleague Kelly Madigan in Baltimore County. And questions were raised about who should have oversight over the inspector general. You're going to be investigating people in the city, so what people in the city should be overseeing what your office is doing. So talk about the structure. Who do you report to? Obviously the city council approves your budget, but tell us about best practices and what we do here in Baltimore City.
Well, this is an area where Baltimore City actually shines. We have I'm actually the first vice president on the national basis of the Association of Inspector Generals. And so I get the opportunity on the government committee to see others. And our office has a citizens advisory board. Now, just 3 years ago, we had actually one of the worst advisory boards in the United States, because our advisory board was made up of the mayor, the council president, a councilman, the comptroller, and a solicitor. So all five were within the jurisdiction of the inspector general. And there came a time where I had done an investigation that I was asked to do involving a state's attorney, and the advisory board decided to meet for the first time. And that's when we brought forth that this was a conflicted and this is not best practices. And it was the citizens of Baltimore that there was an amendment brought forth by Odette Ramos. And the citizens of Baltimore voted 89% to make this advisory board set up the way it is. So my advisory board is actually made of the two deans of the law school, because Baltimore has two law school deans.
University of Baltimore and University of Maryland.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And then we have one person that's from the Association of Certified Fraud Examiners and one person that's a certified public accountant. And the rest are made up of the different 14 jurisdictions. And what happens is the citizens apply, and then, for instance, since there can't be 14 people on it, what they do is they pick a name between the ethics director actually picks a name between whoever was selected in District 1 and District 2, and that becomes that person. And then the same thing for 3 and 4 and all the way down. So the advisory board is truly citizen-based, and it's truly independent. And when I say I do not work for the administration, I really don't. This group is the one that selects the next inspector general. They do my evaluation. They're the ones that bring forth the budget even. They're the ones that are supposed to. Sometimes I'm the spokesperson, but they're the ones that approve it, because in order to really have an effective office of the inspector general, it has to be for the citizens. And so, of course, the citizen advisory board. Because otherwise, you know, influence can happen. And if someone doesn't like a report you've done, you know, who happens to be elected, then it can actually impact greatly. And we see that happen throughout the United States. So people are actually, like, Howard County has a new inspector general, and it was based on Baltimore City's. And they're talking about starting one, I think.
So the board and the oversight.
Yeah, the oversight, yeah.
Situation.
Models ours.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, people. So this is an area where Baltimore does shine.
Let's talk about what happened a little bit in Baltimore County.
Yes.
Your colleague, Kelly Madigan, mm-hmm. was up for renewal. She was appointed for a four-year term.
Five-year
term, thank you. And Johnny Olszewski appointed her. There is a different county executive now. Johnny Olszewski was elected to Congress, so Kathy Klausmeier became the county executive, and she will be in that role until the next election, the regularly scheduled election. And there are, at the latest count, 490 people running for Baltimore County Executive. But she wanted to appoint somebody else all of a sudden. Explain from your perspective kind of what happened there and why it's not best practices to do it the way that County Executive Klausmeier appeared to approach the issue.
Well, first, to have the person that you could, for instance, and I think it's clearly explained in this way, I was hired by Catherine Pugh. I was part of the investigatory team against Catherine Pugh. So that puts the inspector general, that's why the person, the group that oversees and selects it should not be the person that's under the jurisdiction. It's an inherent conflict of interest. So that's just, in fact, when I met with every one of them, the positions I had investigated, every one of them. So when Kelly, she immediately sent a letter and an email to the county executive asking to meet and let her know that she was very interested in continuing on. And it was radio silence for 4 months till she finally was able to meet with her, and she was given a letter with no warning that says, you can apply again. We're not going to appoint you. And it's just that it's not best practices. What should happen? It should be an advisory board, and to determine whether, you know, that's what happened with me. We met with the board and they decided they wanted, because they're the ones that are constantly reviewing me. They're the ones who are my oversight. So as opposed to a woman or the county executive who had not even been there very long to suddenly and had never spoken to Kelly Madigan, let alone reviewed anything. So why?
But the issue is that even just the way that situation is set up, I mean, the fact that Johnny Olszewski appointed her was not best practices.
Correct.
Yeah.
And that's what they're trying to change.
Yeah.
In fact, I think Izzy Patoka has brought a new bill.
He was a county councilman in Baltimore County.
I'm sorry. He's a county councilman. He brought forth a bill to change this to be more similar to what's done in Baltimore City. So it will be much more of an independent because it's a difficult job. I mean, it is a difficult job. You just have to be moving forward constantly, and you have to let things go, and you have to keep just focused on the mission of bringing out the truth. You can't let it be political.
And your current term runs through when?
I have 6 years, so I have 1 year down. It runs till I am very old, so that is a scary thought. I think it goes to 2030.
Mm-hmm. But when that time comes, the advisory board
will be picking a new inspector general. I will not be doing it again.
Because you know that really, it's really important for people. I mean, first of all, and I know Rick Hutzel had a wonderful piece in the Baltimore Banner about the need for inspectors general, but the cost savings and the great advantage that jurisdictions get. He mentioned Baltimore City, Montgomery County. You know, they've uncovered all sorts of stuff. And to do that, you're obviously not going to have some friends in high places. You know, I mean, so to have the mayor be directly involved, or the city's attorney, right, or the, you know, you can't have people directly involved. Right. I think it makes sense to almost everybody. You mentioned the ethics director. It's a guy named Chris Amberger.
Yes.
What is the role of the ethics director in the inspector general's office? Ethics seems like a very important thing for our public officials to adhere to.
It's an incredibly important thing that is held high by the public. And the public actually moved the ethics group into my office. So the ethics group is under my office. Ethics, you hear it all the time. It's so important. I can't do it all, so I have designated, because I technically am the ex officio ethics director. I designate that to Chris Amberger. He has a board that oversees him and makes the opinions very, very, and there are five people. Actually, there's only four because there has been an opening now for 2 years. The mayor has not been able to appoint somebody for that position.
City officials, for example, need to file reports with the ethics committee.
Oh, yes.
If they, you know, are going to do something that could even, you know, not only be considered questionable.
Yeah, not only the elected, everybody, and lobbyists too. We run all of that as well. I mean, the amount we have the pictures here. What do we get? 1,300. You know, questions about how to fill the financial disclosures, which are open to the public. And that is one thing that we've been fighting very hard. We're getting a new computer system so that it'll be easier for the public to be able to read these financial disclosures. There's a lot of information in them. And all that information belongs to the public. You know, we are all the product of taxpayers. And I mean, I can't stress that enough, shining a light on what's going on in government. And we, an independent inspector general, brings the public hope because it's their watchdog. It's their taxpayer watchdog.
Isabel Mercedes Cumming is the Inspector General of the City of Baltimore. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you want to join our conversation, our number here at 410-662-8780. That's different than the number you use to pledge in our fall membership campaign, but we'd love to hear from you if you have a question for the Inspector General. Let's go to the phones to Tom, our good friend in Mount Vernon here in Baltimore. Welcome to the program with Inspector General Cumming.
Yes, good afternoon, Tom and Ms. Inspector General. I was wondering, since the Inspector General's office is vital to our city and it do save a lot of money, I would suggest that some portion of the money that is saved could be earmarked to increase the budget for the Inspector General's office.
Well, I bet you're singing a tune that our Inspector General would love to join in on the chorus. Thank you for that call, Tom. Your budget is about $2.6 million for the current year.
Correct.
It's approved by the city council because it's part of the overall city budget, right?
Yes.
So it's going to be subject to a little horse trading.
Oh, it is. And a lot of other jurisdictions have what's called a designated funding stream for the Inspector General so that it comes out of some a tax, you know, the water, whatever. It comes out of something so that the politicians cannot impact it.
Would you suggest that that's a best practice for us here?
If it was something that doesn't impact the taxpayers too much, because I am ridiculously conscious.
Because you're not calling for a new tax.
I do not want any more two taxes in the bulk. You know, this annual report that I'm showing him, it's a hard copy. I wanted to make these so that when I go out and visit, I could give my older constituent people. And it turns out these are $11 and I can't waste that money. I can't waste that money, the people's money, for $11 to have a booklet to give somebody. So it's online, and they can see it at oig@baltimorecity.gov. But I would be 100% in favor of taking a stream that went to something like that's already in existence and put it into the Office of the Inspector General so there is true independence on the finances too. But I do not want any taxes. No more.
Isabel Mercedes Cumming is the Inspector General for our city of Baltimore, and we'll have more with the Inspector General in just a few minutes. And before we continue our conversation with Baltimore Inspector General Isabel Mercedes Cumming, this note about the passing of a highly respected and influential educator, Earl S. Richardson, a former president of Morgan State University, died on Saturday. Dr. Richardson served as president of MSU from November of 1984 until June of 2010. When he retired and became president emeritus, Dr. Richardson taught a graduate-level course for several years. Dr. Richardson will perhaps be most remembered for starting a legal fight for equitable state funding. That fight took 15 years. It was settled in 2021 with the state directing $577 million over 10 years to Morgan State and to the state's three other HBCUs. Earl Richardson was 81 years old. And if you've just joined us, we are talking to Baltimore City Inspector General Isabel Mercedes Cumming. So far in 2025, her office has received nearly 900 complaints. 13% were from individuals working in or for the city of Baltimore. And Inspector General Cumming does join me here in Studio A. So, Madam Inspector General, it's interesting that most of your complaints come from what kind of person? What demographic? We said the 13 come from, you know, people who actually work in the city, but 59% come from whom?
Well, I think it's important that 246 are anonymous. So many of the anonymous are actually city employees because they don't want any type of retaliation. They're scared. So, I mean, I think the number of employees that we get numbers from are
probably a little higher.
A lot higher. Mm-hmm. A lot higher, because that 246 numbers should almost all be included in the 118. But we get, that's why something like YPR and doing these type of things are so important, just making people aware of that our office is here and that we work for the public and that we are independent, you know, with an independent advisory board. So we really try to work with the community and to get out and let people know that this is the hotline. And we've done a pretty good job, because I will tell you, when I started, the number of hotline complaints was 72. So I'm now at almost 900. And the number of what we identified went from 240 to almost 11 million. And that's some pretty big change.
And We should remind folks that not all of the complaints concern, you know, criminal conduct. I mean, you don't have to be breaking a law to be investigated by the Inspector General's office. I mean, you should just, you know, for example, at the DPW, if they're not making water available and toilet paper available to the employees, there's no statute that says you have to. But of course, best practice would say you've got to take care of your people and make sure that they're safe.
Right. It's more that we take the time to listen, read every complaint, see what we can do. And we get complaints from citizens who have had a truck in front of, you know, a truck in front of their house, a DPW, for too long, and we will send a referral for that, or a water bill that's just so off, and they claim that they've tried to reach out to everybody else. We are sometimes really the office of last hope, where you go when nobody else has listened to you, you know, and that's what we hear the most, that this is the office that actually, you know, really turned it around and did something for us, which I think is why our numbers keep growing, because, you know, I tell people in my office who, major shout out to, I've had no turnover for over a year and a half, and they love this city, and they listen, and they want to make this city better, so they go out of their way to try to see. I mean, my whole team got up at 5 o'clock in the morning to do those DPW.
I know, we talked after a couple of days where you yourself went out there at 5 o'clock
looking bad,
in the morning.
Absolutely. I mean, unless you walk the walk, you can't talk the talk. That's for darn sure.
We have an email from a listener who says, is the status of pending and completed inspections and any conclusions from the investigations publicly available online?
Oh, yeah. Once.
So these are the ones, I guess, that are underway, currently underway.
Okay.
So you don't even tell us who they are, right?
That's 100% true, because if I was to tell anybody what those were, it could be, and people could use my office as a weapon. They can say, Oh, I've turned so-and-so in, especially an elected. I've turned so-and-so in. They're under investigation by the OIG. And it could be completely, which a lot of our cases are, non-founded. The last thing you want is this office used as a weapon. So I neither confirm nor deny that an investigation is ongoing until the report is issued. That's the only way that it'd be fair.
Now, there are some very egregious breaking of the law on some of the cases you've investigated. One had to do with a group or a person who was trying to divert about $1.5 million from the city. They came up with some fake invoices or something, and it was a fraudster. They didn't quite get the $1.5 million, but they tried to get the $1.5 million from the it was an electronic fund transfer.
Correct.
Payments called EFTs, right. Which was intended for a particular vendor, but it turns out it was all fraudulent. How does something like that happen?
There's always a little bit of human element. And once somebody knows the system, what they did is they went into our system and they changed. It was actually a long fraud in that they went into the system and they changed the address first of where the invoice would be paid. Then they went in and they changed the bank account. And then they went in and eventually they had it so that the routing number was changed. And there were supposed to be, at that time, checks and balances, but everything was done online and no one called back to see, called back our original. But by doing it systematically like that, if they would have called back, they would have called back the fake number they had provided. So a lot.
Okay, so that it's confusing to people.
Yeah,
so
no,
in other words, here's a vendor who legitimately deserves to be paid for services that it provided to the city.
Yeah.
And someone went in and changed the bank account of the vendor, changed the address of where the vendor was, so that the money got diverted to that
other account.
Nefarious person rather than the actual vendor. So does that require a city employee to change the information, or can a person actually do that from outside?
They can do it from outside. It was most likely someone from who may have worked at that outside company and knew some of the systems, because they had to go inside our workday and then change it from there. And so it would be we did a very big investigation, this one. It was most likely someone from the outside. And that one we are working with federal investigators on still.
So that is an ongoing investigation. But
it is.
They I guess submitted one set of invoices that they did get paid for. It was about $800,000. And then the other part of it, another $700,000, that was caught in time, I guess, right?
It was caught actually by the bank. because we had shipped the money out, but the bank realized that this was a tremendous amount of money to go into an account that may have had, you know, $200. So it was actually, the second one was actually caught by the bank.
And when it comes to these kinds of things, again, obviously, you know, the city comptroller's office, the finance department has to, you know, change their protocols, right? I mean,
well,
are
sadly,
you satisfied that that's happened?
This was the third time this has happened, because the accounts payables went from the finance department to the comptroller's office. So in the process of doing that, some of the internal controls had not been communicated as well. In fact, when this situation happened, we were dealing with the comptroller's office, we're like, you realize this almost exactly happened 3 years ago? And they're like, no. So it's like, you know, that's where like experience definitely plays a role. But to their credit, since that, we have moved forward, changing systems so that moving forward, this will not be happened again, God willing.
There have been some questions raised about your own ethical status when it comes to the DPW, and I want to give you a chance to respond to this. The DPW, their union, Local 44 of the union that represents the sanitation workers, held an election, and people complained that you sent out a tweet on your private account that said, that mentioned one of the people running for that office. That election, as it turns out, has been contested. They're going to do a do-over of the election, so it's a little messy. But let me have you respond to people who said you shouldn't have been involved, even on social media.
Those tweets were on my personal social media. I never once mentioned a person. I never said who to vote for. My office interviewed 130 workers when they did the DPW case. And in the report, we mentioned that the workers were unaware of when elections were and where elections were. So if you carefully read the tweets in question, it clearly says where they are, when they are, and please vote, never saying who to vote for. And I think that's really important. Another thing that was mentioned in the article that you're talking about was that I boost some of my tweets. When I think something is important, I will pay money out of my own account to boost them. Not one of those tweets were boosted. What was boosted was when I felt my office needed additional people. I used my own money to boost those tweets. I also boosted the tweets where the men of DPW, not Isabel Cumming, the men of DPW spoke their truth, that they didn't know who the union was, that they didn't know and they couldn't buy eggs, and that they have gone through terrible situations. Those are the ones I boosted. I did not boost any of those. And quite frankly, it is interesting that it was, because I asked the reporter, I said, who's complaining? The union complained. Because I think it was another newspaper did an incredible editorial saying that the control is what is being lost with this. And the fact that so many workers turned out, because it was a historic number, almost 300, and though 300 workers actually came out and voted for the person that they wanted, and yet the union has decided, based on something that makes no sense, that this should be done again.
And
there probably should be an investigation.
And we will certainly follow developments in that election. Isabel Mercedes Cumming is the Inspector General of Baltimore City. Thanks for your time. Thanks for coming over. We'll be in touch.
Thank you. Thank you.
And that's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, the University of Maryland's new Innocent Project Clinic with the Carey School of Law seeks to overturn wrongful convictions. We'll talk to the clinic's director, Erica Souter, whose clients include Adnan Syed. And we want to thank everybody for tuning in to WYPR on today.